Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about America's public lands and the outdoors. I'm Aaron Weiss from the Center for Western Priorities, coming to you on an unseasonably warm winter's day in the Rockies. In a minute, we're going to talk about the past, present, and future of the West's iconic animal, the bison. We've saved it from the brink of extinction, but now what? Can buffalo and cattle and people coexist? We've got a conversation with the creator of the Threshold podcast, Amy Martin. The entire first season of her show went in search of answers, plus the discovery or rediscovery of Mesa Verde this week in Western history. But first, let's do the news. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The Trump administration's war on your public lands continues at full speed. The latest incidents, slashing the number of free days at our national parks. In 2016, there were 16 free days to celebrate the Park Service centennial. This year, there were 10 free days. And next year, you will only have 4 chances to experience our national parks for free. That is a 75% cut in 2 years. And it comes as Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is trying to more than double how much it costs to visit our most popular parks in peak season. The administration likes to talk about the park's maintenance backlog, but the sad fact is that jacking up admissions fees won't even make a dent in the maintenance backlog. You're talking about raising maybe $70 million with the fee increase versus billions of dollars in deferred maintenance. In other words, only Congress actually funding our parks will be able to address our parks' maintenance needs. But meanwhile, Secretary Zinke is dealing with another round of bad headlines about his travel. You know, back in April, he decided to take a bunch of his friends and donors on a government boat ride to Channel Islands National Park. So the Park Service was going to pick up Zinke and his wife Lola, a relative, and their friends at Ventura Harbor. But that would have required Zinke to drive 35 whole miles down the road from their house. So the secretary insisted on being picked up in Santa Barbara, adding 3 hours of overtime for every member of that boat's crew and an extra 8 hours worth of fuel on board. The total cost to you and me, so that Ryan and Lola Zinke wouldn't have to drive down Highway 101, $2,000. Now, we don't have time to get into all of it on this episode, but this junket to the Channel Islands gets even worse from there, and we may spend a little more time talking about that in the new year. Our guest this week is the creator of Threshold, a podcast that does a very deep dive into a single story from the natural world each season. The first season ran earlier this year, and it focused on the history and the future of the American bison. It is a very compelling listen. Amy Martin is the host and founder of Threshold, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks for listening.
First off, of all the stories you could tell, given your own, I guess, self-imposed guidelines for the podcast, why start with bison?
You know, it's a little bit a matter of something that I'm interested in and logistical realities, because you're right, there are so many topics I want to cover. But I've lived in Montana. Well, I moved here at the very end of 1999, and I've been interested in and hearing about the bison story ever since. And it was something I got really interested in when I first moved to the state. And then, like a lot of Montanans, you kind of get tired of it because it keeps coming up year after year and never seems to change. And it seems a little depressing or frustrating. And so I had gone through that cycle and come out the other end and kind of come into this curiosity of like, why is this topic so complicated? Why is it so hard? Why can't we seem to make any progress on it? Right around the time that I was conceiving of Threshold, and I did have a whole kind of menu of ideas, and I thought, well, I might as well start with the one that's closest to home and probably the one that I know the best in terms of having some personal, you know, experience with it. So that's why I dove into the bison story.
So let's start at the beginning of the podcast. You take us to Yellowstone National Park. This is the place where the bison was literally saved from extinction. There were at one point only 23 bison left. But now, as you point out, in that herd from Yellowstone, hundreds of them get slaughtered every year. How did we end up in this situation where we saved an animal and now there are, I guess, too many of them for where they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really tricky about bison is they were saved they were one of the first animals that we kind of recognized as a culture that needed to be protected from extinction. And so they kind of got saved early in the conservation story, in the story of the conservation movement of the United States. And because of that, some of the awareness that conservationists have now that you can't just save an animal, you have to save a habitat in order to protect an animal. Those ideas weren't as fully evolved at the time that we saved the bison from extinction. And so the way someone explained it to me was basically that we, you know, we got to the point where like, okay, we've saved enough that, that they're not going to go extinct. And then everyone kind of just turned their gaze elsewhere and said, done, good enough. And didn't really think about the fact that these, you know, this is the largest land mammal in North America. And it needs a lot of space. And so just saving the animal is not the same thing as protecting the species as a wild animal, you know, in perpetuity. And it's in a way easier to save the bison than to save the space that we need for the bison. So that's the struggle that we're kind of still in. I mean, Yellowstone National Park is a really big place, but bison are meant to roam and they don't always stay within the lines on the ground, the invisible lines on the ground that, that we have made for them. So depending on the weather conditions in the winter, when it gets really cold and snowy in Yellowstone, they want to leave the park. They want to move to lower ground to try to find food. And that means that they go onto state land, they go onto private property. And then we're just left with the question that we've really never answered as a society, which is how willing are we to try to live with this animal? What are we willing to do? What are we willing to change? What additional space are we willing to make to allow this animal to have the space it needs to be a truly wild animal in our country?
One of the things that struck me fairly early on in the podcast is how the story of the decline of American bison was also mirrored in the story of Native Americans and what happened as white settlers moved west. And it seems like a lot of the tribal members you talk to are also, they're very aware of that, those parallels.
Yeah. I mean, it's a slightly tricky thing to talk about because I don't at all want to be equating human beings to an animal. And so I definitely don't want to oversimplify or to try to speak for anyone. But I will say that, I mean, many Native Americans told me, and it's also just, you know, pretty well documented in all kinds of places, that the pursuit of, especially the end of the bison era, did coincide not just, you know, it overtly coincided with the destruction of Native American cultures or the attempt to destroy Native American cultures. You know, the period in the late 1800s, when the remaining tribes that were really strong and still, somewhat, you know, intact in the U.S. were all kind of concentrated in the Great Plains. You know, those were some of the tribes that were the most dependent on bison. And so there was never a law passed that said, you know, we're going to try to wipe out the bison in order to wipe out Native Americans. But there were all kinds of statements made and even documents, memos passed down from government or military officials saying, hey, this is an idea for a strategy. These tribes are really strong. They're really good on horseback. They keep outwitting our army. They keep beating us in these battles. But we could starve them out. And, you know, it's a pretty awful thing to have to confront in American history. But it, you know, it happened. And it was a big part of how the U.S. Was able to bring those nations down. And it wasn't only, you know, the lack of food, but the way that the lack of food opens people up for disease and for, you know, internal conflict, and also just the massive cultural disruption, not to mention the fact that the bison was used for a lot more than food. It was clothing, it was shelter. So it really struck, by wiping out bison, it really struck to the heart of Native American cultures. I want to also just say, though, that, you know, a big part of that was happening economically. It was not only militarily, or even in some ways primarily militarily, that the bison wiped out. It was largely because all these factories were going up in the eastern part of the United States, and they were producing goods for the rest of the country and for Europe. And they needed all these belts to run this new industrial equipment. And it turns out bison hide makes really good belting. And so, you know, we can't just sort of point the finger at any one sector of society. It was just like so many of our environmental problems, like everybody has a hand in creating them. And there were also people in the military and in the government, including elected officials and military leaders who were trying to stop the slaughter of the bison and stop the destruction of Native America. So, you know, it's complicated. There aren't really, you can find people on all sides who did good things and who did bad things, but it definitely is true that, that wiping out the bison was a big part of trying to overpower Native American cultures and a big part of the reason why that was, successful.
So you've laid out all the various pieces of this puzzle you had to work with, the history, the tribes, the ranchers today, the biologists, the park rangers. At some point, you must have realized, I have this humongous story to tell. I'm going to try to do it in 7 or 8 episodes. What was your storytelling process as you realize all of these various moving pieces you somehow have to craft into one coherent narrative?
I'm laughing because I think my storytelling process was insanity. I was like swimming in tape. There's so much great tape that didn't make it into the show. You know, to this day, it kind of kills me. Like, there's certain people that I'm like, oh, I wanted to get you in the show so badly. It was a really fascinating challenge to try to take everything that I had gathered and figure out, you know, how to weave it together. And I'm in that same process now for season 2. And I guess maybe the best way to say the process is, maybe after I do this like 10 times, I'll be able to like tell someone in 30 seconds, here's the process. But for right now, it's like, oh my gosh, it's just a lot of listening and writing and drafting and trashing things and pulling my hair out and staying up all night. And it's intense. It's fun, but it's intense.
So that's where we are today. It seems like now that these bison populations have rebounded, they could theoretically thrive if we let them roam free. Some, or maybe a lot, of cattle ranchers across the plains in the West aren't cool with that. Walk us through what's their argument for why we shouldn't have herds of bison roaming the West again?
Well, again, I also had to be cautious to say, you know, I definitely don't feel like I can speak for all ranchers, and there is a lot of diversity within that community of how people think and feel. But I think for the people that I spoke with who are opposed to expansion of bison habitat and expansion of bison populations, I think they have a number of arguments. One is public safety. You know, they're concerned about what it would mean if bison, you know, wander outside of the areas that we want them to be in. They're large animals. They're worried about their fences, and they're worried about their barns. And, you know, this is a thing I think that sometimes can get skipped in conservation work, is that, you know, a lot of times it's people in cities who are pushing for conservation of a species, and then they come and kind of visit that animal and leave it. And it's people who live in the interface between the wilderness and the urban areas, often, you know, farmers and ranchers who actually deal with the reality of that animal. And so I heard that a lot, like, you know, yeah, everybody loves bison from a distance, but what's it like to actually live with them? But I think at least in the Yellowstone area, you know, the largest concern there, or a large concern there, is this disease called brucellosis. And it is a bacterial disease that was actually brought over to the Americas from livestock from Europe. And it used to be a real big problem, especially for dairy producers in the United States. But it's been slowly eradicated in livestock. but cattle are capable of transferring the disease to wild animals. And so both bison and elk in the Yellowstone area have become reservoirs for the disease, and they are able to transfer that disease back to cattle. There has never been a documented case of a bison transferring that disease back to cattle in the wild, but they have made it happen in a lab, so it's theoretically possible. And elk have transferred it back to cattle in the Yellowstone area. And that's a really big deal for ranchers, because if you take your cattle to sale and they get tested for brucellosis, everything changes for you on a dime. You have to potentially slaughter some of your animals, possibly even all of your animals. You go into quarantine. And in addition to the emotional cost of, having to kill your animals because they have this disease, it's a huge financial cost. You know, this is how people make their living. And so there's like a stigma to it, you know, like suddenly you have this like disease, you know, nobody wants to be the person who goes on quarantine for anything. So that's a really big deal for the people in the Yellowstone area. But I do want to make sure that people understand that it is only the bison in the Yellowstone area who have been exposed to brucellosis. There's lots of wild bison in other places, and brucellosis is not an issue. So, and some of those bison are being opposed by ranchers, and some not. You know, some ranchers are saying, great, let's have more of this animal. There's no reason why we can't all live together. Those voices are maybe not always the loudest, but I definitely talked to people who felt that way in the ranching community.
So from everyone you talked to, do you think there is a way forward? Does it involve either the bison range that you talk about in Montana, where there's talk of transferring management? Are there other ways forward that could lead to wild bison across the West someday? Or does this feel like a stalemate to you?
You know, I think it's absolutely possible for there to be more wild bison in the United States, not only in the West, but maybe primarily in the West, where we have done such an amazing job of preserving so much public land. You know, there are public lands out there that are perfect habitat for bison. Bison are incredibly adaptable. They can live in all kinds of habitats, and that are far away from roads, far away from human development, and the chances that, you know, there'd be this massive bison migration out of some of those wilderness areas or parks or BLM lands or national forest lands into areas where they would really cause major problems for humans is very small. I heard from people who really know this animal and know how they behave and know what they need. I heard from people over and over and over, this is totally possible. It's just a matter of will. We just haven't actually decided how much we want or don't want this animal in our country. And I think maybe people don't understand that it really is. It's a choice. It's a choice we just haven't quite made as a group yet. And I think everybody can understand that we're never going to have a time where we go back to having 50 million bison in North America, or at least we're not going to have that time anytime soon. And it wouldn't do the bison any good if they were free to roam down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, or, you know, walk through the downtown Tulsa, Oklahoma, or whatever. But this is a huge country with a lot of land. And, you know, right now we have United States and Canada together have about only 30,000 bison that are actually considered truly wild. And of those, at least half are in really small herds, which some people debate if that should even be called wild, because bison need the herd to truly be what they are. So that means, you know, we have essentially 15,000 of these animals where we used to have 50 million. There's a huge gap between those two numbers, you know, and maybe we're not going to have even 10 million, even 1 million. But could we have 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 wild bison, a million? You know, I think there's absolutely enough space for them. It's just I don't know if we have enough mental space for that.
As you think back to all of the reporting you did, putting season one together, is there one moment or one person who really sticks with you as you look back now?
There are so many people who stick with me. so many people who really touched me with their openness and their willingness to really dive into this issue, even when it was uncomfortable for them. If I may, I think I'd actually like to just mention two people briefly.
Of course.
One of them is Robbie Magnan, who is the Bison Project director, and actually he's the head of the fish and game for the Fort Peck tribes in northeast Montana. And he is so positive and so full of excitement, and had such a really interesting and touching story about what bison and connection with this animal had done for him personally, just in terms of him becoming more personally connected to his Native American roots, and the ways in which he sees bison as lifting up people in his community. The tribes on the Fort Peck Reservation, like a lot of Native American people, you know, they don't have a lot of economic opportunity, and it's a very isolated place. There's, you know, issues of poverty, drug addiction, and, you know, suicide and all these things. But bison are this force for good in his community. That's how he sees it. And he's connecting kids to these animals. He's getting them out onto the land. He's just seen them transform lives, and hearing him talk about that and actually being out there on this beautiful land with him and seeing them, it was a magical experience for me, and I'll never forget it. And I feel so grateful to him for his time. And the other person who just leapt to mind when you asked that question is Dreska Kinky. She is a rancher who is living near Yellowstone in an area called the Paradise Valley, just north of Yellowstone National Park in Montana. And she is a super smart, super hardworking, fun, funny woman with a lot. She thinks deeply about a lot of things. And she has landed on the side of the bison debate that she's really not in favor of their expansion. But sitting down with her, I visited her twice. She talked to me for a couple of hours both times. And she just really opened up to me and let me see inside her world and how she arrived at where she is at. And I feel like in our super polarized society, it is such a gift to just sit down and let, you know, have a conversation and let people, what am I trying to say? She exposed me to the way, how she arrived at where she was thinking in a way that really made me empathize with her. Mm. And, I was just really, grateful to her for that time and that openness.
Let's look ahead. Your next season, I saw your Instagram feed is filled with pictures from Alaska. So I'm guessing that's what season two is about. What else can you tell me about what you've learned so far, and I guess how you put together these pieces for whatever your next story is?
Yeah, well, I bet there's a bunch of Alaska pictures most recently, but if you go back a little bit, there's some from Greenland and there's some from Norway and Sweden, because the whole next season is actually going to be about the Arctic. And what we're trying to do for the next season is think about the many different, or at least some of the many different environmental issues that are playing out in the Arctic, but we're really trying to tell these stories through the eyes of the people who live there. I think there's a real danger in the Arctic that it often gets represented in the media as an uninhabited, desolate place. You hear the word desolate all the time when you start paying attention to Arctic stories. And there are 4 million people who live in the Arctic, and they have some really interesting cultures. And they also have a really up close personal view of climate change. So we're going to be talking about the Greenland ice sheet. We're going to be talking about the Sami cultures in northern Scandinavia and their reindeer herding operations and the challenges they're facing. We're going to be talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we visit the village of Shishmaref, which is on the coast of Alaska, which is in one of the places that's most in danger of being, that the island is essentially washing away as due to climate change. So we're going to be taking listeners all around the Arctic and introducing them to people there and letting them tell their stories in their own terms, in their own ways, and teaching us what they know about life up there.
Since you're reporting on the Arctic, and you mentioned the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that puts you in a position where you're wading into a very live political debate that's unfolding right now. How does that change your approach, knowing that you're a few months out from running with this? And is this going to be the kind of thing that potentially ends up being more of an evolving product if, say, things are happening in Washington that affect the National Wildlife Refuge as your podcast is posting?
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. I mean, there's a way that that was true with the bison stories, too, in that there's a lot of debates and, you know, these kind of regular meetings that change policies and stuff. But yeah, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge thing, I do feel like it probably for the next season is going to be the thing that's the most time sensitive, reflecting the news cycle the most closely. So we're probably going to do a bunch of writing and editing and then have to change it at the last minute, I'm guessing. You know, this is another one of those issues that's been going on for years. The Gwich'in people came together in the 80s to try to stop the first attempts to do oil and gas drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and they've been fighting it ever since. So unfortunately, it is it's probably not an issue that is going to go away by the time that the podcast comes out. And yes, it looks like that there is a lot that's moving on that front as we speak. So it'll be it'll keep things interesting for us and hopefully for the listeners, too.
Are you thinking beyond season two? What other kinds of stories do you want to tell down the road if the funding's there?
Yeah, we are thinking beyond season two. I mean, I want to do this for the rest of my life. I love doing this kind of reporting. It's fascinating. I feel like it's necessary. It's a challenge. And so, yeah, I've got so many ideas. I think I'm probably not quite ready to broadcast what I think season three might be about yet, but I'll just say I have ideas for sure.
Nice. Amy Martin is the creator of Threshold. You can find it at thresholdpodcast.org. Season one is up right now. It's about the American bison. Season two is coming when?
I think that we're thinking it's going to drop in May.
Nice. We will look forward to it. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you. I appreciate being on your show.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was this week in 1888 when a couple of ranchers, Richard Wetherill and his brother-in-law Charles Mason, stumbled across the ruins of Mesa Verde in southwest Colorado. Wetherill and Mason were searching for stray cattle when heavy snow started to fall. They were on top of a broad mesa, and they were worried they might fall off a cliff in the snow, so they dismounted and started walking. When they came to an overlook, they could see through the snow to a stone city, three stories tall, perched up on a cliff wall. They gave up that search for their cows, managed to climb up and explore the ruins for several hours. The structure that they discovered, or rather rediscovered, is now known as the Cliff Palace, a 13th century marvel that once housed around 100 people in 150 rooms. In the years that followed, Wetherill collected thousands of artifacts from Mesa Verde, most of which ended up in museums where they can be studied and properly cared for, but many other pieces of native history were stolen by visitors, and in order to protect the site from more looting, Congress created Mesa Verde National Park in 1906, all thanks to a search for lost cattle this week in 1888. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you like what you hear, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. That's the best way for new listeners to find us. We've gotten some great ideas from all of you for episodes coming up in the new year. We'll be talking about sage grouse, we'll be talking about uranium near Bears Ears and the Grand Canyon, and a whole lot more in the coming weeks and months. If you've got a topic that you think we should cover or a guest that we should talk to, please drop us an email. podcast@westernpriorities.org is the address. Thanks again to Amy Martin from the Threshold Podcast. You can find that, well, wherever you found us today. And I'll be keeping an eye out for season two of Threshold next year. We'll be back in 2018 as well, of course. I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, have a very happy holiday, and we'll see you in the new year.